Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on August 19th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Evening, everybody. I'm Adam Walker. I'm the head publicist for premieres here at Film Forum. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight for the U.S. theatrical premiere of this fascinating documentary, Beltracchi, The Art of Forgery. We're very excited to have the writer and director of this fine film, Arne Birkenstock, here with us tonight from Germany. Arne is an accomplished writer and filmmaker with several feature documentaries and books of nonfiction to his credit. He's an instructor and consultant for several German film schools, is on the board of the German Film Academy, and is also a member of the German Documentary Association, European Documentary Network, and the European Film Academy. After the screening, Arne will be joined by the noted critic and author Blake Gopnik for a Q&A. Blake's writings on the topic of art forgery have appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, The Daily Beast, and The Washington Post, among others. He's also author of the forthcoming biography on Andy Warhol. Please stick around for what I know will be a great conversation. And now, to say a few words of introduction, please help me welcome Arne Birkenstock.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, thank you to Ian Stimler, Kim Stim, and to Adam and the team at Film Forum for inviting me here and my film. It's the first U.S. theatrical release in my career, so it's a really great moment for myself. And I'm really happy about the passion and the professionality, how you guys do this all here and make films to find their way to the audiences. So you're going to see a film about a man who is hated by art dealers, but he also is a personality who is loved by filmmakers because he is ambivalent, because he is charming and ruthless, because he is technically clever, but he's a criminal. So I hope you enjoy the film, and normally this film provokes quite a lot of questions and discussion about the guy, about the subject of art forging, about the art market. So I'm really looking forward, and I'm really happy and honored that Blake Gopnik will join me. I think we can have a really interesting discussion about it. So please enjoy the film. Have fun.
Please help me welcome back Arne Birkenstock and Blake Gopnik. Okay, so we'll take some questions from the audience in a couple, but first I just wanted to ask, Arne, could you just give us a little bit of an update on Beltracchi and what his current situation is?
So we are not in contact because he is not very fond of this film, but I know he has been released in January from prison, and he's painting, of course, with his name, but also in the style of others. I'm quite sure. I think if not himself, his wife would prevent him from doing other, because they were like 1.5 years in the closed prison, and she really suffered much more there than he did. I can't believe that he does it. And actually, when he participated in several television shows, he wrote a book, his autobiography, and he is selling his paintings, of course, for other prizes. He's doing now paintings in the style of Max Ernst, signed by Beltracchi, and there seems to be a market for that. I think he's not living as luxury and rich as he did, but he can make a living. But actually, his income, he has to give the most part of it as part of the civil lawsuit. He has to give it to his victims, to the people who claimed a loss.
And Blake, so I was reading your New York Times piece earlier, and you've written in sort of in praise of forgers and sort of Beltracchi and the fact that they sort of have their place in the current art world, art market. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that interests me most about Beltracchi, and that in a sense I admire most about him after seeing the film, is that he undermines the whole notion of authenticity, or he should, right? After seeing a movie like this, our reaction ought to be, boy, the whole notion of unique works of art that have kind of magical auras around them that can't be reproduced obviously doesn't hold water, right? And moron like Beltracchi can make pictures that hold up under expert scrutiny should make us think that the whole expert system is wrong, that the whole notion of the unique object is wrong. But weirdly, that's not the result. Somehow or other, instead of saying a moron like Beltracchi can do this, we all say, ah, what a genius Beltracchi can be if he can copy Max Ernst. And of course, what he's doing is a kind of manual copying. He's not actually copying Max Ernst's way of thinking. But it's very strange. We still somehow associate forgers with the actual masters instead of seeing them as, well, I like to think of them as posthumous assistants, right? He's Max Ernst's greatest assistant, and it's just bad luck that Max Ernst happens to be dead.
Thank you for that. Just wait for the microphone. We'll get the... Just right there.
Well, I think two things. First thing is that he was not in control, so that is a problem he has just with everything, I guess. Second thing, I mean, he gets a lot of room in the film and he talks a lot, but I think he talks to his good and to his worst. So you have, I mean, if you have him saying he is more a genius than Max Ernst is, that doesn't elevate him, that dismantles him also. And then I guess the major point is that he sees himself as an artistic genius, and I think in this point the film is quite clear at several points, saying, of course, there is a huge difference between the craft of me copying a style to being an artist and having an original idea and whisking something with that idea in the artist's time. So I guess that is the point where he is most vulnerable, seeing himself as an artistic genius.
Yeah, I think there's a certain poignancy. At the moment where he's making his own, those terrible works with the angels, he knows they're terrible, right? And there's a strange quality where he realizes all of a sudden, or has realized all along, that actually he's a loser, despite the fact that he can manually copy these other artists. And that's, I mean, after all, he spends all his time living with great works of art, so he realizes perfectly well that his aren't any good.
Yeah, and of course he is hurt when he is there in his workshop with his art historian and he's asking him, what do you suggest? What should I be doing for a living? Should I be staying with Max Ernst and other classical modernists, or should I do my own stuff? And the art historian says very politely but still very clear, no, please don't do your own stuff. Good.
Thank you. I'm just curious. He gets found out after 40 years. What sparked the doubts?
Well, it was he used a ready mixed color, a white color, and did not realize that there was a very low percentage of titanium white in that color, and this titanium white had not been in use during the time when this Campendong was supposed to have been painted.
But remind me, Arna, did they have doubts based on connoisseurship? Is that what led them to do that test? I'm sorry, I just can't remember.
No, this was really... Normally, Beltracchi, he was quite clever. He did not go first to the art dealers. He first went to the experts, and then he went with the painting and an expertise to the art dealer. If the expert would have said, or which happened, no, this is not an original, he just wouldn't have brought it into the market. So it was a quite a nice way to avoid risks. So in this case, the auction house was so urgent in bringing that painting into the evening sale and on the top front page of the catalog and selling it as a sensation, as the best Campendong ever painted. It turned out to be the most expensive Campendong ever sold. So then the buyer asked, has there ever been made an expertise? And then, that's true, the art historian who is doing the expertise for Campendong said, I only will do an art historical expertise if there is a scientific expertise before that.
And one of the things I'd just like to mention, because it just was in the news yesterday, is that the so-called experts can be incredible sorry, I'll use the word again, losers. I don't know if you heard, but there was a Warhol that sold for $247,000, I think, recently, or not in, yeah, earlier in August. And it is so obviously not a Warhol that it's just unbelievable that a bunch of experts, so-called experts, I can't even imagine who they were, declared it a Warhol, authenticated it, and put it on the auction block. So it's the whole notion of expertise is incredibly loose. It takes almost nothing, especially in this country, to be a self-declared expert. In Europe, things are a little more controlled.
I mean, the question is, how keen is the interest actually to dismantle a forgery? We have a guy who is a greedy criminal who does it to make a lot of money in an easy way. But of course, he enters a market which is not lacking greediness also. So, you know, you wonder, there pops up a collection, this so-called collection Jaeger, suddenly, has never been heard of before. And this collection contains only out of masterpieces and only out of masterpieces which have never been seen or shown or sold or whatsoever. And nobody asks a question, what's about that collection?
I mean, what I always think is that forgers do a huge service to the market until they're discovered, right? They create new stock. Every company, every retailer needs more stock. They help stock the shelves of the art market. And it's only when they're discovered as forgers that there's a problem.
Yeah, it is interesting, I think, how in Germany, in the discussion of the film and about the entire case, how the art market dealt with Beltracchi. They either described him as some kind of a devil, or they described him as some kind of a genius, which is a very obvious strategy, because against the devil or a genius, I can't do anything. If I would describe Beltracchi as what he is, just a very normal, maybe clever, but normal forger. He's not the first one who did this kind of thing. There have been forgers before and will be afterwards. So if I describe him as a normal forger, I have to deal with my own behavior. How can I close the doors for future forgers?
That's very interesting. I mean, it could be that forgery is not all that hard if you're willing to be immoral. It could be that if we encouraged forgers, if there was a huge market for copies, for instance, or derivations, that we'd have hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of forgers just as skilled as Beltracchi. Luckily, most of us have some moral compass, and we don't go out and try to see if we're any good at this thing called forgery.
Actually, it was funny. Last month, I was giving a workshop to Southeast Asian filmmakers in Vietnam, and they decided not to show this movie, but another one of mine, because they said nobody in Vietnam will understand what's the problem with Beltracchi, because they have so much copying there, you know.
I mean, it is actually important to point out that many, many cultures in the world now and through history have no concept of forgery. The ancient Greeks thought copying an important work by Apelles or a sculptor, Milo, was perfectly normal and acceptable. It's only pretty recently that we've introduced this notion of the unique, authentic work, which then creates the notion of the forger.
Any more questions? Yeah.
Well, a lot of ideas come up here, just where you have this idea of a knockoff being the forger. But there was acceptance... 20 years ago, I guess it was, or a little bit more, there were artists that were obviously copying other artists, but that was considered postmodern, and that was definitely part of the New York art world and got into Switzerland, Basel, whatever, which is very interesting. But, you know, there's a lot of elements that go, and your work, your film is going to be definitely considered very important at a certain level, because it's going to be looked at and criticized as something as a part of, or he, Beltracchi, is going to be considered to be part of something that is more than just a forger. Because he obviously, there are things that he's doing. I wasn't sure what he was saying with the Brock and the Fries when he was going to the actual site where they painted, and you know, obviously there was some erosion to that rock too, since it was painted. But it's, you know, what was he doing there? Was that actually, was he attempting to do a forge painting, or was he just painting to the delight of painting the site, like many painters do? They want to paint where a famous artist did, and the idea of a masterpiece is, as you know, is to copy the master to make a piece that looks like the master's.
Well, you know, that is totally legal and totally allowed. The problem starts when you sign it with a master signature and sell it as a masterpiece. And that's maybe the difference to the concept art you were talking about. And when he was in front of the mountain, actually you see this paint, or the start of these paintings later in his workshop when he shows them to this art historian. He does it in the style of Braque and Fries.
Yeah, I think that was a great moment, and also the whole movie, and to me the most interesting part was the idea of this, the thing that maybe makes forgery difficult and makes him, he's not technically sitting there with a you know, picture. He's not trying to copy something. It's an enactment, and it's like a hard-earned spiritual calling, he's calling forth something. I mean, it is, he complicates it, and sort of there's like a genuine, exactly like you were saying.
You know, that's a strange concept. It's always said, right, that they inhabit the spirit of the dead artist, and I'm just not sure why we believe that. It turns out that forgery's not that hard. You'd imagine that inhabiting the spirit of a dead artist would be something incredibly difficult to do. I'm not sure why we have to imagine that. Can't we just say something a little more pedestrian, like he figures out how to make a picture? I mean, no forger copies a picture, because if the picture already exists in the world, then you don't have you don't need a forgery of it. It would be very hard to pass it off. So I'm just wondering why it is that your instinct is that he's doing something quite elevated and complex and spiritual.
I don't know if it's a hard thing. I mean, I don't think anyone would claim that art is hard. You know, it's a state of mind. So that's what it would be. It would be some sort of clearing out of like detritus or some sort of you know, all of us could make it, right? It's not that art is hard. It's like literally not. It's just some sort of clear state of mind. You know, and I think he's obviously doing that. So,
I think actually much more interesting for me in what he did is not so much how he did the paintings, but what his sales strategy. I think more than
that's real art.
More than an artist, he is a narrator. He really provided the market and the expert with a narration, with the things they wanted to hear, with the tracks they wanted to find. And with the footprints they wanted to find, and there strategically, like the combination of knowledge, of ruthlessly, and also of intelligence, this is something I can say, okay, there he achieved something. It was criminal, obviously. But like the manual copying of a style, I agree with you. It's not so much.
I mean, I think, you know, I'm an art historian, and there's no one in the world who thinks more highly of artists than I do. But of course, the clearing out of the mind, the crucial act is the creative act in the sense of innovation, of originality. That's where something really happens. And that's what Beltracchi never even approaches. If he could inhabit Picasso to the point where he made a completely new and original contribution to the entire history of world art, that is not making something that looks like a Picasso, but making something that functions like Picasso, then he'd have achieved something. But of course, that's something no forger has ever done.
You know, on one level, he's very much like a muckraker, because whether he understands it or not, he's actually exposing the incredible foibles of the whole concept of art, and who uses it and for what ends, and how art has actually been co-opted as a kind of a hedge fund game for a very few people. But he's also, or you can say he might also expose something much more problematic, which is that since we know that art has been forged since ancient times, it was forged for political reasons as it is today. It's, you know, archaeological materials that are being dug up every day are only part of what comes on the market as either stolen art or art that should be restituted or whatnot. But because half of the things that are brought illegally onto the market in that sense are also forgeries. I mean, the market is a glut of things made now and things kind of pulled back from other times in the service of political ends, which are financial ends. I mean, the finances of these things and the people who buy quantities of expensive art, often to let's say, get tax write-offs by donating them to museums, are playing, you know, the inverse of the same game. But there's something else, which is that everything that you're speaking to has to do with the beginning, with in a sense, the impressionist and post-impressionist movement. What is the meaning of an artist, you know, as this personal genius, as opposed to someone who was commissioned, let's say, in the 12th century to paint frescoes, or commissioned by a lord to paint, you know, something else. I mean, there are so many ways to approach art, and as you said, the whole issue of appropriation, which has been either ill-conceived or well-conceived.
I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off, but other people want to ask questions too.
It's a beautiful looking film. Could you say something about the filming of the movie?
Yes. So I got to know Beltrakis after the verdict was spoken, and we had I didn't have finance the film and nothing. We had a really short time frame where he was not in jail and where he could move outside Cologne and where the two houses were still available because, of course, they were taken away. So we did a first little shooting period in his with him in his house in southern Germany and in southern France. And then he had all this procedure, and then he at a certain point he went into this open prison or half house, I think it's called here, and we were able to shoot with him in his workshop in Cologne. So we were shooting on an Arri Alexa, which is a really high-end digital cinema camera, which I wouldn't recommend for a reportage with elephants in the jungle because it's heavy. But of course, for this shoot in the workshop with lots of colors, with close-ups and so on, it was a perfect thing to do. And we shot about, altogether, I would say, 45 days with him in a period of about a year, separated about a year. And the whole production took 2 years.
Thank you so much. I really, really love this film. I wanted to find out from you whether or not you have seen a film called Art and Crime by 3B Productions out of Berlin.
No, I have seen the American film called Art and Craft, which was about an American forger. Mm. No, I haven't seen that one.
It's a new film, and some of my footage of an Italian-American art forger from New York is in it, as well as three or four characters that are in your film, and it's very interesting. I think
I have to get it then. Interesting. Yeah. Thank you for the hint. Yes, thank you.
Selling now with his name on it.
There was a story just recently that it's. I gather it's selling out. There's a waiting list for his work, and the prices are soaring. So, I mean, it actually makes me sad because those things, if you imagine them as investments, and I sure hope no one does, they will be worth absolutely nothing in 10 or 20 years. But Arne had a really interesting insight into that.
Yeah, actually, if you think about a certain class of people, like rich people with big, kind of show-off houses, but not like old collectors, for them, already the formats of classical modernism are way too small. They want a Max Ernst 3x3 meters, you know? And so they get it, and they don't have to spend several millions. They can get it for 30,000, and they don't have to deal with something complicated as art history. They can just say a talk about a crime comedy kind of thing. So I think there is a certain market of people who really love this kind of stuff.
I like the idea of the enlarged modern masterpiece, you know.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.